the seismic Supreme Court ruling on presidential immunity that could shape America for years to come.
There is a principle that nobody is above the law, and it has always been understood that the president himself has to abide by the law. This opinion, not only does it grant this immunity, but it grants the immunity in some really sweeping ways, I think go far beyond anything anybody could have assumed.
Plus, thousands of Palestinians displaced multiple times already are ordered to relocate once again.
The latest order is a sign that Hamas has managed to regroup, and we could soon see Israeli forces moving back into Khan Yunis and a resumption of heavy fighting.
And the European leader with the closest ties to Russia meets with Ukraine's president in a rare visit to Kyiv. Today is July 2nd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Lori London. Israeli forces bombarded several areas of southern Gaza Tuesday, and thousands of Palestinians fled their homes in what could be part of a final push of Israel's intensive military operations in 9 months of war. Associated Press correspondent Yosef Fetterman reports.
The Israeli military has ordered a mass evacuation from a large part of the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis. This isn't the first time we've seen an evacuation order like this. Israel spent several months inside Khan Yunis battling Hamas before withdrawing earlier this year. The latest order is a sign that Hamas has managed to regroup, and we could soon see Israeli forces moving back into Khan Yunis and a resumption of heavy fighting.
AP correspondent Yosef Fetterman. Gaza's European hospital in Khan Yunis is virtually empty, with staff and patients fleeing after the Israeli army's orders for residents in the surrounding areas to evacuate. UNRWA spokesperson Louise Waterridge.
UNRWA estimates that around 250,000 people have been impacted by these orders. Of course, as usual, we expect these numbers to grow. But, you know, for us, this is it's another devastating blow to the humanitarian response here. It's another devastating blow for the people and the families on the ground. It seems that they are forcibly being displaced again and again. You know, making these decisions is now impossible.
Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken affirmed Monday that President Joe Biden's proposal to end the Israel-Hamas conflict is achievable and urged Hamas to accept it. Blinken also underlined the importance of post-war plans to rebuild Gaza and prevent a security vacuum in the territory. VOA's Veronica Balteras-Inglesias reports.
As Israeli troops continue deepening their incursions in Gaza in search of militants, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced Monday that Hamas's military capabilities have almost been eliminated.
We are advancing to the end of the phase of eliminating the terrorist army of Hamas, and there will be a continuation to strike its remnants.
The announcement was made as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, in an interview at the Brookings Institution in Washington, called on Hamas's leadership to accept a phased peace proposal currently on the table.
I think the proposal that President Biden put forward is achievable, and it would be the best way forward, the quickest way to end the conflict in Gaza, to stop the violence, to massively surge assistance, to get everyone home, including American hostages.
As the secretary spoke, the voices of protesters gathered outside the Brookings Institution could also be heard. Blinken, who didn't acknowledge them, stressed that the Israel-Hamas conflict cannot end with a vacuum in Gaza.
It has to end in a way that makes sure that there are clear, coherent, achievable plans for Gaza's governance, for its security, and of course, to start to help people to rebuild their lives that have been so decimated and destroyed.
One of the Palestinians whose life has radically changed and wants accountability is Dr. Mohamed Abu Selmeya. The director of Al-Shifa Hospital was released early Monday after being in Israeli custody since November. He says prisoners were subjected to severe torture and his little finger was broken. He was repeatedly hit on the head until he bled. He says there was almost daily torture in Israeli prisons.
We were subjected to severe torture.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
But overall, I think the Electoral Commission here has to be commended for a job well done.
That's VOA's Paul Ndiho on the performance of Ghana's Electoral Commission as he continues to monitor results from Accra. Details coming up. Also, there is uncertainty ahead after Syrian rebels oust President Bashar al-Assad. And gunmen have kidnapped more than 50 women and children in Nigeria's northwest Zamfara state. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. After a thorough review of the votes from across the country, the Electoral Commission of Ghana has officially declared John Mahama, candidate for the National Democratic Congress, NDC, as the winner of the 2024 presidential election. For more details, I talked to Paul Ndiho, our VOA reporter in Ghana's capital, Accra, who has been closely monitoring election results.
Thank you, Your Highness. Yes, we officially have a president-elect by the names of John Dramani Mahama, who is coming back for the second time. He lost a re-election in 2016. Finally, he managed to secure a comfortable 56.6% of the total vote. His opponent, Mahmoud Bawumia, scored 41.6% of the vote. But overall, I think the Electoral Commission here has to be commended for a job well done.
You are so very right, Paul. The declaration for the presidency was done by Jean Mensa, who is the chairperson of the commission.
Yes, Jean Mensa has been at the forefront of Ghana's Electoral Commissioner for a couple of terms now, done a remarkably good job to the extent that even the opposition, people who are coming into power, commended her for having pulled off one of the closest election. Initially, it was a close election, but when things started trickling in, it was not even close. The opposition managed to win hands down. So to their credit, they say she did a remarkable job, and they wanted really Ghana to go forward.
And Paul, as you well know, Mahamudu Bawumia actually conceded a few days ago, right away, before even the results were coming in. Former President, President Akufo-Addo, yesterday, he has called to congratulate Mama.
Ghana is ahead when it comes to how they have conducted elections. They have had experiences being in power and outside of power. So it's usually a smoother transition when it comes to who wins and who loses. There is no question about that. What Mahmoud Bawumia did was a remarkable thing to the extent that he conceded before even the election results were announced. Why? Because they had their own internal polling. They looked at their own internal data, and that data could not change. Based on that data, their own internal data, they were able to say, we are not going to win this, therefore I have to inform the nation that this is it. I've come to the end of this campaign, I have to concede. And he did so graciously. Every single person that I've talked to, most of the people that we've met, from the observers to the ordinary person on the street, they commend him for doing that, for coming out even before the Electoral Commission announced the election results and conceded defeat. So people are looking up to him as a statesman, as a hero of sorts, because if he had not done that, there was definitely going to be tension or some kind of insecurity on the streets, because people are already gearing up to do whatever they need to do. But thank God that did not happen. He had the foresight of looking at it from that perspective and decided to concede before even the general election was called for.
And I guess what's left now, Paul, is the transitional process and possibly, you know, the inauguration.
Yes, that's going to happen very fast. According to President-elect John Dramani Mahama, the outgoing president, Nana Akufo-Addo, has invited the incoming president for a lunch and to start this transition on Wednesday, tomorrow. So they're going to have a sit-down, talk about the transition process, and as they await for the official inauguration in January. The outgoing president has invited the incoming president for a sit-down conversation at Jubilee House. So that's going to happen on Wednesday. And I think the two will talk about what is it that they can do to take their country forward.
That's VOA journalist Paul Ndiho speaking to me from Ghana's capital, Accra. Israel has pounded Syria with dozens of airstrikes in the 24 hours since the fall of President Bashar al-Assad, who fled to Russia under pressure from rebel factions. It's unclear who will now emerge as the leader of Syria. Joseph Siegel, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies of the National Defense University, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam the Assad regime was hollow and it can no longer rely on Russia for military support.
The regime itself had become, you know, very corrupted. They weren't merit-based. They weren't really unified for any sort of national goals or ideals. This is all a very patronage-based and politicized set of institutions. And so when the regime was threatened, there really wasn't both the will or the capacity to respond. You know, it also underscores that the Assad regime was there because of the external support that it had. It never had legitimacy or popularity within Syria. You know, it was being propped up by the Russians primarily and Iranians. And with their being distracted in Ukraine and in Iran, within Iran and in Lebanon with Hezbollah, they were not able to come in and rescue Assad this time.
What about where things stand now? It seems to be a big question mark. Who is going to be in charge with these rebels that were able to take over? What happens to the government now that he just fled so quickly?
Well, it is a period of great uncertainty and nobody really knows. Probably the rebels themselves don't know because they have been so focused on the military aspects. And so this will be a very fluid period in the coming days and weeks. You know, there's more than one rebel group, and so they are going to have to try to couple together some sort of governing coalition. Indications are that the rebels have communicated to the respective ministries in Syria that they want them to continue to perform their functions, that they want a smooth transition, that there won't be there won't be uniform action taken against those working with the Assad government. Really, the focus is on those who were most in the political leadership. So, you know, that bodes well for a smoother transition. There does seem to be some dialogue happening between some senior members of the former government and the rebel leadership. And so I think it will remain to be seen whether the rebels are able and willing to live up to their pronouncements that they're, you know, that the purpose for their actions was to restore interest in the rights and the will of the Syrian people.
There's a lot of concern in the West, including the United States, that, you know, the ISIS is going to take over or some other insurgency group that is not friendly to the West. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, ISIS remains a priority for the region and internationally. By all accounts, ISIS was not a part of this movement. And so, and with the recent U.S. strikes against ISIS, clearly, they seem to still be on the defensive. Of course, as we said, this is a fluid period. All actors in Syria are going to have to recalibrate their posture, you know, their coalitions. And I'm sure ISIS is looking at ways that they can take advantage, and if there's a vacuum, to try and fill it.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. He was speaking to VOA's Carol Van Damme in Washington. An armed gang kidnapped more than 50 women and children in a raid on Kakin Dawa village in Nigeria's northwest Zamfara state, according to police and residents. Zamfara police said the incident took place Sunday and that additional security forces were being deployed to the area. Reuters News quoted residents as saying dozens of assailants on motorcycles arrived in the village armed with assault rifles and went from house to house kidnapping residents. Kidnapping for ransom by gunmen is rife in northwest Nigeria due to high levels of poverty, unemployment, and the proliferation of illegal firearms. South Africa has introduced a 45% tariff on all clothing imports, regardless of where they originate and no matter who the buyer is. Labor unions say the tariff will protect the local clothing manufacturing and retail industry, but many South Africans are unhappy with the move, as Darren Taylor reports.
South African tax officials have told VOA that Chinese clothing companies are the main targets of the new tariff, which went into effect last month. They say the 45% tax is a response to two Chinese fast fashion online marketplaces. Shein and Temu export products from China directly to individual consumers around the world. In South Africa, that allowed their customers to avoid tariffs normally charged to retail companies that order in bulk. Their clothes have been extremely popular in South Africa because they're cheaper than locally produced apparel and imported goods sold in shops. Michael Lawrence, the director of the National Clothing Retail Federation, says the new tax and the closure of loopholes means that's no longer going to be the case.
It's always terrible to pay more, but it is important that we live in a society where rules are applied equally and fairly, and we pay 45% duty and 15% VAT in every other trading environment. So this should be no different just because of the particular and peculiar modality. And it also seriously undermines both our manufacturing capacity and our ability to have good, responsible retailing to consumers.
The South African Revenue Service, SARS, says the new tariff will save thousands of jobs. The policy officer for the country's largest textile workers union, Etienne Flock, welcomes the new tariff.
You know, one of the most important things about the rise of these new large e-commerce retailers, including Shein and Temu, is that they use a business model which we think really belongs to the trash heap, you know, comes out of the 1990s. There's great exploitation of workers, huge overtime, people not able to rest, low wages, but also the products that are being made is very low quality. People wear it a few times and then it ends up on the trash heap. So it's not good for our planet.
The two companies have been quoted in South African news media as saying they'll comply with all laws in the country. But many South Africans are unhappy, saying international online outlets provide their only route to cheap clothes. More than 24,000 citizens have signed a petition calling on SARS to scrap the clothing tariff. Consumer activist Lehandri Smit says many citizens started shopping online to escape inflation.
We know South Africans have this year really, really felt the brunt of the impact of food prices increasing as much as they have. People have had to change their shopping habits, the brands they buy, how they buy, where they buy, what they buy. We've seen people are even removing the frequency of meat and replacing it with grains, for example, to make a meal stretch.
Flock says the higher tariff will increase the market share of local manufacturers, meaning prices will eventually come down as local businesses grow. But that's little consolation for South Africans who've ordered Christmas gifts from the likes of Shein and Temu. The country's Free Market Foundation says much of this clothing won't be claimed at customs because the buyers will not be able or willing to pay the 45% duty. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1 202 258 3076. Every Wednesdays, we'll be sharing our listeners' comments on Africa News Tonight. Police in Kenya hurled tear gas canisters today at hundreds of protesters against gender-based violence and femicide in the capital, Nairobi, and arrested an unknown number of people. The Associated Press reports that protesters were chanting "Stop Femicide" when police dispersed them at a public park and later engaged in running battles along the streets. Several protesters were injured. Kenya has a silent epidemic of gender-based violence. In October, police said 97 women had been killed since August, with most cases linked to male partners. Last month, President William Ruto committed more than $700,000 for a campaign to end femicide after meeting with elected women leaders. U.S. President Joe Biden's first and only trip to the continent before leaving office next month was aimed at strengthening ties with a focus on the U.S.-backed Lobito Corridor. That's a massive infrastructure rail project to make it easier to ship ore from the Democratic Republic of Congo and other African countries to the port of Lobito. 70% of the world's cobalt used to make electric vehicle batteries comes from the DRC. Christian Geru Adunima, a China-Africa analyst and non-resident scholar in the Carnegie Africa program, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that the U.S. is far behind China in gaining access to Africa's precious metals, especially cobalt.
It's a commercial project by Trafigura and its consortium. The U.S. is intervening in the project because the U.S. is providing a financial support to the DFC. And that project is basically railway and maybe expanding a bit of the railway in the port of Zambia and refurbish the ports of the railway in the DRC. This is the first part. The second part that you mentioned about copper, the critical minerals being shipped to the U.S., it's not also the first time, even though it can be used. It was through Durban, but it's not really the first time that happened. So here, yes, we do have a case when minerals, copper, essentially not cobalt, copper being shipped to the U.S. by most of it by Chinese miners in the DRC selling copper buyers in the U.S. because the demand in the U.S. is higher than the China. And China being full now, the demand, the price that the Chinese buyers are offering to miners in DRC are low compared to what the U.S., the Americans are offering. So you have a lot of copper that's only being processed and to metal, to 100% metal, out of the DRC, sold by Chinese smelters and Chinese companies, are sold to the U.S. So when you put all of that in context, it becomes really difficult to understand. I might be critical here, but to understand the whole narrative that's been built around the Lobito Corridor project.
With his recent efforts, has President Biden been able to even the playing field at all with China in terms of, you know, access to these precious metals?
No. He's not been able to level the playing field because for him to level the playing field, they need to have mining companies on the ground, which they don't have. To level the playing field, they really need to have actors on the ground. And the Lobito Corridor is just a logistic project so far. And it's really important for people to know that it's not really much of a leveling of a playing field, despite, and this is, I might sound very critical to the U.S., but beyond the narrative that's presented, there's no real American companies on the ground. We do have cobalt in Zambia. who's trying to start a new operation in Zambia, but we do not have an American project in the DRC. And since there's no American project, there's no really leveling the playing field as we would have expected if there was really real competition happening. This is basically the landscape of the mining industry in Africa. You do have other mining companies in South Africa, in Gabon, in elsewhere, but you do not have American companies trying to level the playing field with Chinese regarding the cobalt in the DRC. No, you don't have that.
More than 70% of the world's cobalt, that critical metal, comes from the DRC right now. Is it that the DRC just has a lot of it, or is it because China is already there and they've got mines already there?
No, it's because the DRC has a lot of it. That's it. It's because the DRC has 55% of the world reserve, the whole reserve in terms of cobalt. It's in the DRC. It's not that common. That's why you have EV industry starting to find new alternatives to cobalt, trying to mine nickel, trying to mine lithium, because those are much more common and widespread. Cobalt is really it's more concentrated in the DRC. You do find it elsewhere in Russia and elsewhere in other countries, but not the same quantity that you do find in the DRC. That's why the DRC was able to hold that position of the largest world producers of cobalt.
What does the West need to do then to catch up with China in the race to get access to cobalt in Africa?
The U.S. is going to have mining companies investing on the ground, being present there, starting to produce, investing in the DRC. That's the starting point.
That was Christian Geru Adunima, a China-African analyst. He talked to the VOA's Carol Van Dam from Mauritius. President-elect Donald Trump has nominated New York Congresswoman Elsie Stefanik to be United Nations Ambassador. VOA's Margaret Bashir reports.
I rise today to nominate the gentleman.
Elise Stefanik entered Congress in 2014 at age 30 as a moderate Republican representing a large, mostly rural district in northern New York State. Sally Friedman is a political science professor at the University of Albany.
She initially was not particularly a President Trump supporter, became one, moved up the ranks to party leadership in Congress. So that she is now, until she resigns, the chair of the Republican Conference.
As conference chair since 2021, she is the fourth-ranking House Republican. Casey Seiler is the editor-in-chief of the Albany, New York-based Times Union newspaper.
She did not attend the Republican convention in Cleveland in 2016, and it was really only after his election and his sort of ascendancy, especially among conservatives, that she went, as she has put it, ultra MAGA.
For Stefanik, that meant defending Trump during his impeachments, his claims that the 2020 election was stolen, and being a strong campaign surrogate. Again, Casey Seiler.
She is smart. She is a very hard worker. She is rhetorically extremely effective.
Stefanik rose to prominence during congressional hearings in which she challenged the handling of pro-Palestinian protests on some university campuses. Three prominent university presidents stepped down following the hearings. Here, she questioned Harvard University's president, Claudine Gay.
So the answer is yes, that calling for the genocide of Jews violates Harvard Code of Conduct, correct?
Again, it depends on the context.
It does not depend on the context. The answer is yes, and this is why you should resign. These are unacceptable answers across the board.
In May, she expressed staunch support for Israel in remarks before the Israeli Knesset and has received significant campaign contributions from pro-Israel lobbies and individuals. Trump announced Stefanik as one of his first cabinet picks just 5 days after the election. She will come to the United Nations with limited foreign policy experience as the world body deals with wars in Ukraine, Gaza, and Sudan, soaring global hunger, climate change, and a raft of other crises.
Richard Gowan is the UN director for the International Crisis Group.
I think that it's probable that once she becomes ambassador, Elise Stefanik is going to be focused on the Middle East. She may have to focus on Ukraine. And it seems probable, given her past statements, that she is going to be very critical towards China.
In his first term, Trump cut hundreds of millions of dollars in U.S. funding to several UN agencies.
This time, the organization is making contingency plans for much deeper cuts. In the meantime, Elise Stefanik will find herself on a new international stage. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and our engineer, Adrias Rigas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.